Hey there, Shopomaniacs! You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave. Rupert, I don't have anything clever today. Chris. And Chris Quire's here, too. Hey, Chris.
That's shocking to me, as 2 weeks and weeks ago, you were doing like a Halloween voice, and today is literally the day of Halloween, and you haven't...
Oh, that we are recording.
I know.
Yeah. Okay, let me try it again. Hey, I'm Dave. Thanksgiving's coming up. It's already Thanksgiving. About time when you're listening to this, I'm a pilgrim.
Nailed it. Yeah, you're right, though. It'll be a couple weeks because we're going to air the live show from Jamstack Conf that we did the show the week before this. So listeners, you've already listened to that. I hope you enjoyed it. It was fun for us.
It was fun. And there's a video, too, if there's some jokes that did not quite translate or whatever. But it was
audio only. But we'd be remiss if we didn't send it out to the old RSS feed as well that has a special piece of XML in it that links to an MP3, which is what makes a podcast. Did you all know that, listeners? Podcasts are just RSS, which is just XML.
God's language. It's... Can I tell you a secret story? So I have some bootleg MP3s, right? Some bootlegs of Ursula Franklin talking. Okay. No one tell the FBI about this, okay? Ursula Franklin's like this kind of technologist, but kind of from oldie days, you know, like almost pre web days. Mm-hmm. And she's just the way she thinks about technology. And Ethan Marcotte got me onto this and may or may not have procured some bootleg MP3s of talks that she's given. And my, like, all I've been thinking about is, like, I'm just going to handwrite an RSS feed and I'm going to just chuck it on Netlify at some bogus URL, whatever, Stomping Dragon or whatever. and just have a bootleg RSS feed that I can listen to these MP3s, these 5-7 talks over and over and over in a podcasting app, you know what I mean?
Yeah, because like, the minute that it's a valid RSS feed, you can just give anybody the URL to it, and any one of these podcast apps can suck it in and listen to it there.
So I'm thinking about like a bootleg MP3, secret RSS, sort of empire, and I'm just gonna have these little apps, little podcasts for me of like old stuff, because I can't like listen to it at my desk, you know. That's like a limitation of my brain. Like when I'm sitting at my desk trying to listen to a podcast, it just, no information gets ingested and no work gets ingested. It has to be like on walks or driving or whatever. So like in 2x is kind of a requirement too. I can't just like
Just get a bunch of UX out of doing it this way. I mean, you already have the MP3, so it could be argued that's like, Dave, just listen to the MP3, like that technology exists. But RSS just brings that BYOUX.
Yeah, I get some superpowers. So I'm going to have some bootlegs. Hey. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So it's like dark podcasts, you know, like people have like dark Twitters, podcasts. You know?
Yeah, it's like the alt accounts or the dark web, dark money, dark podcasts. It's the new podcast venture. Mm-hmm.
I like it. Secret.
You can pay me. You can pay me a million jillion dollars.
Do you listen to anything else good lately? I've been now that my arms are getting a little better, I can actually like, it's funny because you'd think, why would your arms? Yeah, really. Why would your arms have anything to do with walking? You think you could walk the whole time they're healing? I mean, I kind of could, but you swing your arms and you walk, and it's just not, it wasn't particularly comfortable. So I was like, off.
I'm sure there's like a blood flow thing, right? Like it just like enough, you know, you move your arm and it's like, ow.
Yeah, right. Or it brings blood more attention to the party that you just don't want. Yeah. But I'm back on the, I'm back on the treadmill now. I'm not doing freaking curls yet. I'm just not cleared for that stuff yet. But I can walk, which means a lot more podcasting recently. I've been just listening to all kinds of stuff.
Well, you know, I've been listening to, a D&D podcast, the McElroy brothers. They do Adventure Zone. Mm-hmm. But they just finished a big arc called Amnesty, and it's like about like playing D&D in a small town in West Virginia. Or well, they're playing D&D, but it's like a kind of like a Monster Hunter, Buffy the Vampire style, like arc where they play like set in West Virginia, Mount like Appalachia. So it was pretty awesome. I liked it quite a bit. I also love Buffy, so that was like very like easy for me to get into. And then somebody showed me The Daily. Have you heard of The Daily?
Oh, yeah.
New York Times.
We listen to that. That's one of the ones that me and my wife listen to together a lot of times because she's like she listens to more podcasts than anybody I know on earth. Just voraciously. In fact, her New Year's resolution was to listen to less of them because it was like too much.
I'm with Marina on that. Like I've got to cut out some eBooks. I waste so much damn time. I've read like 50 books this year. Like listened to like 50 books this year. It's way too much, dude. I need to like pull back and just chill. But this daily is so neat. Like, cause it's just like,
yeah, it's the New York Times and they put it out literally every single day. Right. But it's like high quality, though. Really good.
It's high quality. And it just goes into one story for like 30 minutes. And I just think that's cool. I'm not going to listen to every one, but it's just kind of like this, you know, stuff that like I'm interested in. So I'll just kind of poke around at. So, and it's because it's like one story. It's like, you know, listen to like Marketplace or something like that. It's like 15 minutes, but it's like 72 stories in 15 minutes, you know, and you're just like, what did I just listen to? But this one's just like one little tangent a day.
So yeah, it's worth listening to. You know, Vox does the same thing. Today Explained.
Oh, and really?
I think they're okay. Really good, almost.
I could see that.
So, other than that, oh, that's good. Yeah. That's good. I did, you know, I'm like 50-50 on tech, non-tech podcasts. I almost wish there was like more good tech podcasts. All right, maybe we'll expand it. Not that there's, you know, there's just some, but you know, whatever, without like being a dingus about it. There's some I like and some I don't. Sorry.
I don't want to spoil my video game podcast called A Side Quest, which everyone should check out. I watch YouTubes when I work sometimes too, right? Yeah. And I recently got into watching this one guy play City Skylines. It's like a Sim City kind of game. Mm-hmm. But he only does the traffic management part. So people send him they're like busted up cities, and he just fixes the traffic in cities over and over and over. I've watched 40, 50 of these videos, dude.
Oh my God, Dave.
I'm obsessed, and it's so zen. It's so therapeutic to just watch fix something. Oh my gosh, dude. It's like, and the answer is always the same. It's just roundabouts and
roundabouts are good.
It's roundabouts and public transit.
I remember back in Sim City, it was all about getting the trains going. That was usually the answer.
Yeah. So I've downloaded this game since, and now I'm just like, oh, here's That's how I nice. Waste my time now.
Apple released the Apple Arcade, you know, and it's like $5 mm-hmm. a month or something like that. And I was like, I never can play games. I'm the worst gamer ever. Like, why would I sign up for this? But somehow, just maybe Apple fanboyism, whatever it is, convinced me to do it. And it is kind of nice that I can go in there and there's a ton of games, more than I'll ever play, and I pay nothing for them. And they have this, there's no like upsell crap in them. You know, so I actually am pretty into it. Like, I got into What the Golf. That was pretty fun. You ever do that?
Yeah, that was fun.
Cool. But Mini Motorways reminds me of what you were just talking about, which is like, you know, you're kind of building roads to deal with, you know, cars that want to get from A to B, but you have, you know, there's different objectives. Like the yellow cars want to go to the yellow buildings, but that kind of stuff.
Yeah. How do you get them to do that? Mini Metro? It was another game like that, but it was like, you know, it's basically like, you just plan a subway. You like build a subway based on like people and demands and stuff like that. So
my favorite one I downloaded is called Assemble. It's just this beautiful story of like a woman who rolls into this town with her own story, but she fixes things and, you know, puts up flyers. That's like, I'll fix your stuff. So, you know, people she interacts with along the way. And then at some point you get dropped into the fix it mode, and it's like these 3D objects that you spin around and have to deassemble and reassemble to fix them. And it's a very satisfying experience doing it. But it's mixed with a nice story, you know, so it's kind of cool. I think it might be from the same people as like Us Two or whatever, from the castle with the, you know,
Monument Valley.
I think it's Monument Valley. People? I could be wrong, but I think that might be.
They're good at stories.
But on the podcast thing, I listened to the of course, I'm just a long timer, This American Life, super, super duper fanboy. And the latest one where they went to Hong Kong to do the protest show was real good. Yeah, just brought some perspective to it that I didn't have because I'm terrible at politics and news. Like, I never know what's going on. Sorry, the world.
It is interesting because it's like some stuff I feel very caught up on. I am 100% tracking impeachment and conspiracy theories around that. But then it's like Hong Kong stuff. It's like, man, I know there's like five demands, but I don't know what they are. And, you know, so this stuff would be like, I would love like a digest like that, you know, like a here's kind of
just one kind of mini thing that I found interesting was there's this concept of the cursed generation, which is like people that were born there around 1997. And they're, you know, I don't know the truth of all this or whatever, but people, there's a lot of like really younger people who are like more like just like learning Mandarin and like being like, China is here now and we're just kind of slowly morphing. Going China, and then the older generation of, you know, the parents of a lot of these protester kids, which are these like circa born 1997 people, are kind of just like, don't make waves, like everything will be fine if you just chill out and do your job, and you know, like, what are you doing, you know? But it's this like middle ground people that are the kind of the most pissed about what's happening, and
I could see that because you have like a taste of both, right? Like.
It was like that was the year that it was inked, I guess, this long-term
British
deal.
British Hong Kong and Chinese Hong Kong. So, yeah.
And then, of course, the real story is like these, you know, they're philosophically pissed about, you know, wanting to maintain their freedom and stuff. But on the ground, they're just pissed at the cops, you know?
Yeah, right. Like sometimes it's just like, because that's like, as I understand it, the face mask thing, right? It's just like, don't look at me like I don't want to be tracked or whatever, you know, which I can totally empathize.
Yeah. About, yeah. And then there's like, you know, there's like bigotry the other direction too. You know, there's some interviews in there that were just like, so what do you think of mainline Chinese people? And they're like, they're filthy and gross and I don't like them. I didn't mean to like say like, oh, yeah. But I just mean the podcast itself paints the picture in a way that is typical of that show. They do a good job. But on the tech side, I was intrigued the other week when I saw, you know, DHH get all mad. You know, when Automattic took like, what was it, $300 million? Massive investment from Salesforce. I'm sorry to switch directions so heavily here, but it's podcasting. That's what we're going to...
Hey, tech news. Beep, 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 beep.
And it wasn't, you know, the story is always complicated when you talk about WordPress, because there's WordPress.org, the open source project that, you know, is its own beast. And then there's WordPress.com, which is like the Automattic thing, which runs WordPress multi-site, but is owned by Automattic and is like... for profit in a different way, you know, like it's like confusing, but it's always been that way. It's just the way it is. But Automattic is like not just WordPress.com. They have a whole suite of products, you know? So that investment was, you know, and that's Matt Mullenweg's thing. The investment was too Automattic. So it's not like it's related in some way, and that Automattic people contribute to WordPress.org too. But not as much. I don't know. What is it? 10% or something of the workforce, maybe less. Anyway. So, you know, Mullenweg is interviewed 6 ways to Sunday about stuff like this always. And there was one moment where he said, you know, people are always astounded at how much of the web WordPress powers, which is like over a third these days by most metrics that look at it. And Matt said something like, oh, it's a great number. Why isn't it 80% or whatever? You know, I don't know the quote or what he was quoted in or whatever it was, but it was something like, wouldn't it be cool if we were 85% or whatever? And that, you know, I'm misquoting him there. And I think DHH saw that too and was just like, that's the grossest, you know, how strongly opinionated that dude is about absolutely everything. But he's just like, that's the grossest, most monopolistic garbage I've ever heard in my life, and then invites him on the show to talk about it, and does not mince his words on the podcast about it either. But the two chat it out and have a really great conversation, I think, about all of that. And that's just one of the topics they talk about. But they both like agree and butt heads on a number of things, which made for just damn good listening, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I actually listened to this. I think he tweeted it out this week or something. And I stayed up late at night to listen to it because I'm cool, right? It was cool because I thought DHH made some really good points. I mean, because he says, like, you know, you take investment and now you're beholden to this, to that stakeholder, you know, now like you have a market, whatever objective to appease Salesforce in this situation.
Right, who probably did invest you in the first place because you spun the tale of what if we had 85% market share of the entire internet. You know, like that's probably right. Why they said yes to begin with.
And then from that, Salesforce is like, yes, we want to buy a piece of 85% of the internet, you know, which totally, you know, like that's smart business, I guess, you know. But, you know, and then that probably, you know, let's say WordPress doesn't do it or I don't know. But now there's probably like pressure to like IPO or something like that. And, you know, just with like big rounds like this. And so I think DHH's argument was sort of like it changes the nature of the product and sort of, I guess, the classic, like you've sold out sort of scenario, but it sort of changes the nature or kind of what you're trying to do with the product. But, and he cites a bunch of examples like, you know, Flickr getting bought by Yahoo or things like, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. But it wasn't just like shit turns bad when big money gets involved, but that any consolidation of power is bad.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, but in Matt's sort of purview or, I guess look on it was that's mostly true. Like any consolidation of power tends to be bad, but a lot of them don't have like an open source ethos, aren't open source from default.
Yeah. That's what Matt kept falling back on is like, but we're different because this is quite literally everything we do is open source.
And, you know, I think, you know, I don't necessarily want a web where WordPress is 80% of the websites, but maybe it actually does work for 80% of the websites. And so, but I, you know, all to say, like, I don't think I want that, but like, I think he's right in that. I think WordPress is better than something else. And you know, even WordPress's like biggest critique is like the GPL, its commitment to GPL is like, that's ludicrous. You can't make money off of that. You know, like, but they're like, yeah, no, we are like GPL to the core. We everything's free. And you have to say, if you use any of this, you have to say that that's free, you know, like, it's just, it's definitely different. Does that make sense? I don't know if we have an example.
Right. Cause DHH the whole time was kind of trying to be like, you think just because you're open source, you're different and you're wrong. Is that that's just like, it's just superficially different. It's still a consolidation of power and it's still bad for all the same reasons. And Matt is like, no, that's not quite true. And the conversation is more nuanced than that. I don't think we're bringing anything incredible insight to this. You know, mostly our recommendation here is just go listen to it because it is quite good. It's like a panel at a conference where instead of everybody agreeing, they disagree and it just makes for good popcorn listening. It's good popcorn listening anyway, but it is like highly prescient to what's going on. They compare it to, of course, the, you know, Chrome and Edge situation, and that mm-hmm. that thing is fascinating too. And you know, it was so easy to paint it as it was happening as this is terrible for the diversity of the web because we're losing a browser engine. And I remember I was freaking out to dinner with Matt as this was happening, and he was like, but do not forget about the fact that we're losing a closed source operating system and getting a whole bunch of engineers moving over to work on an open source operating system. That's significant. And in a way, you know, if the diversity of the web might, you know, it's in a sense, it is dropping. There is like a notch down because we have one less browser engine. But if we kind of like abstract up from that, be like, okay, we're consolidating around this one engine, or at least like forks of this engine, that diversity then can come in another flavor, which is forks of an open source environment. Maybe there's just as much diversity, but they share a common core. And that's just a nice way to paint that.
I think that that could totally happen. I mean, you know, in my brain, I'm thinking like, oh, what if you like made WordPress but had caching first party? Like, it's not BYO caching or whatever, you know, like that would actually be kind of a compelling product or something, you know, or some sort of like jam stackable WordPress kind of thing.
Sure. Sure.
Like
if you think there's no innovation to happen in web browsers, you know, outside of how they render, you're wrong. There's a million things you could do. And it's interesting to see more. You know, we talk so much about web monetization around here. You know, we were almost, it was almost an idea to like make it a regular segment, which I don't hate that idea of. But
how much XRP have I earned this week? I'll pull up my XRP stats here while we're
well, here's something related to all this is, you know how, you know, it's been coming up more and more lately, mostly because I think Alex Russell is just extra mad at Apple lately for like resurfacing this idea that you can't run anything but WebKit essentially on an iPhone, and how stifling that is for the web. Well, there's still a little bit of, even though that's true, you can still make a browser and have it, of course, run WebKit behind the scenes. So there's Firefox for iOS. It just doesn't run the Firefox engine. It just runs WebKit too. And people use it and like it to some degree, because then you can like log into your Firefox account and all your bookmarks are synced and it does some special UI stuff anyway. But the reason I brought it up, web monetization, is because there's this thing called Puma Browser, which you can install that. And then it, you know, puts the stuff on top of WebKit in such that the web monetization stuff works with it. So if that's very important to you, you have that. So that's just an example of some kind of like, you know, innovation light, I guess, that happens to web browsers.
Yeah.
Without having to fork the entire engine.
Sure. Yeah. I guess the problem there is like extensibility, like it's not default, you know, like you need default.
Oh, yeah. There's still
problems. And then I can't use Puma as my like in-app browser when I'm in Facebook and I click a link or, you know.
Good point.
Yeah. Facebook. That's terrible.
I mean, it was right at the moment where I was starting to get mad about it too. I'm like, is it about time that Apple opens this up? I mean, my gosh, you know, all the other platforms allow it. It just seems silly that somebody pointed me to this Chrome mishap thing where there was some version of Chrome on some system where it like really borked some really low level system files. Like it screwed it like at the operating system level, like the installation of Chrome got its fingers in there and did some crap to root files that broke some stuff. And it was the story that you read it and you're like, okay, if Apple watches this type of thing happening, like this is like Chrome was really irresponsible in how they handled that. It's no wonder that they're like not allowing that type of low level access on the iPhone. Because you're like, look, when you're in a situation where you can have this power, clearly you use it and meddle in places you shouldn't be. I don't know. I just think that those type of mishaps by Chrome set us back.
Yeah. I mean, Chrome kind of more move fast break things, you know. I mean, so I was digging into yesterday. I was looking at like design systems, right? Like what kind of components exist in every design system? Because I just think they should all be in the browser.
This is also in the water, right? Didn't we heard a little bit about this from Nicole at Jamstack, right?
Yeah. I mean, and I think Jen Simmons has been echoing that from the Firefox side too. But but there was you know, the big blowout this summer was around Toast, right? Chrome was basically
that was
like
a fun one.
Yeah. It was like May 12th or something. The timeline is very rapid, but it was like, I have an idea. Okay. June, intent to implement or whatever. And it was just like, and people just were like, whoa, what? Like,
right. And the Toast element again is this like notification that pops up to tell you like, oh, hey, your disk usage is low or your grandma texted you or something.
It's like an on-page notification. Like, file saved. Grandma texted, or you have a new message in this other channel you're not looking at right now.
So it's true that it's an okay idea, right? It already exists. It's not something that they invented. They're just saying a lot of people do this. Let's ship a custom element that has that kind of styling and behavior of one.
Yeah, it is also very Android material design. Windows has a toast pattern, you know, but it is sort of like material design as a toast. Let's put a toast in the web, you know. All to say, like, I think like an on-page notification sort of like with Aria built in, like alerts that, you know, polite, you know, urgent or whatever, or what is it? What are the Aria? Polite and aggressive or something? Or anyway, I'm blanking right now, but the, like all that stuff kind of built in or programmable through props would be awesome. So I think it's like a good idea. I think like the way they went about it is kind of weird. But inside that, there's another element kind of proposed on the same sort of track called switch, like, which is like, you know, like a toggle switch.
Okay.
You know, that you see in Apple UIs and all kinds of UIs. Seems helpful for the web, right?
Yeah.
Like, that'd be cool.
So it's like a fancy checkbox. Sort of.
It's a fancy checkbox. It's the programming is kind of like a range slider from 0 to 1. Like those are the two options, but it has a button kind of around it. So if you click the input, it just goes from 0 to 1, 0 and 1 to 0 back. Like it's kind of just like a range slider because all of it's like WebKit thumb or whatever. Like that's the styling interface, you know, is through the thumb.
Okay. So was this quite literally also a Google thing, or was this came from
this
a different
was another
company?
Google thing? I think literally the same repo. So it's this idea of standard elements like std-switch and std/toast.
Yeah. This is an important distinction, right? Is that these are not, we're not talking about an alteration to a core web element. They're just like bonus elements or something, right?
They're like bonus elements. And I think the idea that Google was doing for like shipping them was like in your JavaScript, if you want to use standard switch or whatever, you say like import parentheses std:elements/switch or whatever.
So
it has like it's.
So is it using built-in modules? Is that the idea?
I think it was kind of like we're going to sneak these in somewhere that you can access them through this std:elements sort of path of some kind.
Right. There's like literally a JavaScript file that ships with the browser, and you can like ES6 import style in JavaScript in which to like bootstrap up that component. Yeah. They've been playing this with this also with that key value storage thing, the like local storage replacement. If you want to use that, it's a built-in module.
Like that is so cool. But I could also just I think it's a good distribution mechanism possibly, but I also like, hey, we need to have conversations before you like start stuffing things in a browser, you know, like as an author, I need a way to polyfill this for other browsers. I can't just like standard element/switch that's not in Firefox right now. And I don't know when they're going to put that in there. So I can't, you know, it's not in WebKit. It's not in Mobile Safari. So like this doesn't work for me. And I worry this is like a giant vendor prefixing kind of situation. Like it's vendor prefixing, but with elements, you know.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, maybe it is, you know. I've been trying to watch stuff like that. I think I even asked you had more examples than I did, because it seems like you have to have a watchful eye over browsers on what they just ship out the door, and I didn't have a lot of good examples of browsers actually doing it in a really dangerous way. You know, like if one browser were to just ship some new CSS thing totally unprefixed or not behind a flag, that's the moment in which all the sirens need to go off. Like, oh my God, I can't believe you just did that. Now you've shipped an unflagged thing that was, you know, all by yourself, and now authors are going to use it, but it doesn't work in Firefox, and we're just back to the dark ages, you know? That's just not how things work anymore. Like, slow your roll. There is no good examples to point to that are that clear, but there's like little baby examples of things, you know? You had more of them than I did, right? Like there's some web component stuff that happened like that.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite, link rel import, you know? Like that's just got shipped, and Polymer, a whole framework, leveraged it, you know? And then now it's like, well, Firefox is like, we're not doing it. And so now it's like, you have to back off of it, you know? And thankfully that feature was like polyfillable or whatever. So it could work in other browsers, but like it's just, you know, that feature's kind of getting rolled back. So it's just, you know, stuff like that, like things like in a monoculture, whatever, like things can just go out like the standard switch, you know, you think of like a new kid joining, they're like, what, free switch element? Perfect. I'm going to use it. You know, it's like, oh no, don't use that. It doesn't work everywhere. So
I guess it should be said that this interesting import mechanism for these things isn't, they can still just ship it and it's still the same problem as it was, even if it was a standard, you know, or an actual standard.
Yeah, standard. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it would technically be the same problem. I mean, Details had this problem for a while. You know, I think Details that, you know, it's different too when you're talking about like form controls, right? Because form controls have to work. So,
yeah, right.
There needs to be something that works, you know, under the hood. With like these though, like input or like, you know, detail summary, like it just fell back to HTML. Like you had an unexpanded accordion instead of an accordion or whatever. Like, but now it's getting, you know, now I see myself like wanting to use details and stuff kind of all over the place. So I really need to be careful because I don't know, you know, I'm sure Adrian Roselli is going to write a blog post about how I'm using it wrong, but, but like I, you know, there's, you know, I have to be careful and make sure that I polyfilled it and stuff like that. So I'm just kind of talking, but I think it's really important to like, I don't know just how browsers are going to release these things. I don't know, generally concerned, I guess. I don't even know how we got to this topic, maybe about monocultures and owning everything. Yeah, I don't know. I have one more. So the toast element, right? It came out. I was like, whoa, process foul. Like, scale it back. But had it been like a tabs element or an accordion element, I would have been like, perfect.
Yeah.
Everyone needs it. You know, but because it was like toast and so like similar to like a Android only kind of thing, I was like, nah, you know. But if they...
I expect that this will develop. There's the right momentum behind these standard elements that I expect that we'll see it. Although I think, a year or 2 years ago, I would have assumed that at this point that even container queries has come and gone as a solved problem. And we are nowhere on that problem. Although I've been hearing it talked about a little bit more and more. So
have you tried resize observers? It's basically the same thing.
Yeah. But I think the new vibe is like, well, we can allow it under like really like strict conditions, like, so we'll see what happens there.
Like,
you know,
what was it? Contain, like,
yeah, containment,
contain X,
and also that you might have to put a style tag within the element in order to do it. Which I was like, that's actually like fine with me because I like that scoped approach to styling that just never took off. Yeah, I freaking think scope styles is like a big deal. Like I'm ready to die on that hill. Like I like scope styles. Scope me, baby.
Oh man. Scope. We could have probably like avoided this whole like CSS and JS whole thing with scope styles. I mean, just like the whole, I don't know, if we had a mechanism that kind of worked in most browsers, it would have been good.
Yeah, but I agree.
Like a lot of dev energy went into solving this like local stock component level styles, and we already had a thing, but now we don't. So
yeah, I mean, there's also ancient blog posts on CSS tricks about that. And by scope styles, I mean literally a style tag, like with angle brackets around it, and an attribute that says scoped. Mm-hmm. It used to exist, believe it or not.
It used to exist.
It got ripped away.
Well, and that goes back to the shipping too fast thing, right?
Right.
Like that was like maybe too much of an invention for the time, or... You know, I'm thinking of like, and that was went with the whole web component, Shadow DOM V1, you know.
Think about how beautiful it was, though. Oh, my God. You didn't have to do anything special. And now they're like, well, we have Shadow DOM now. Shadow DOM is freaking complicated.
How many episodes have we like tried to pierce the Shadow DOM verbally?
Yeah.
Like it doesn't, it's hard. It's hard to understand and hard to explain and hard to comprehend. And
that like developer experience thing is a big deal. That if it's so hard, people aren't going to do it. You know, like some people are, whatever, but But, you know, it's like that with container queries, too. It's like it's great to get it a little bit, but way less people are going to do it if it isn't really easy to do. So, you know, a container query that just works in regular CSS, people use the crap out of it, you know. Mm-hmm. But a container query that's too weird and has all these caveats won't get used.
It's what is it about humans here? This is a humanities podcast. What is it about humans that when there's a problem with something, we encounter a problem where like, oh, that's that thing's fault, not my fault. I understand it. It's that thing's fault. I'm done. I'm out. It's not me. It's that thing. What is it? Is it like there's probably a thing, like a bias kind of thing, like a confirmation bias sort of thing, or like a.
Certainly.
I'm going to look it up. I think I know it, but I forgot the name of it. The bias where you think you're always right.
This episode is brought to you by CloudBees Rollout. CloudBees Rollout is where developers come to ship changes at will. CloudBees Rollout allows you to manage feature flags at scale so that you're empowered to continuously and intelligently roll out changes as soon as they are code complete on any platform, even mobile. You can decouple development from code releases for real-time change control, roll back only the changes you want. CloudBees Rollout also allows you to deploy features to different segments of your user base, segment by any property or attribute, and create static and dynamic segments. You can also use multivariate flags for A/B testing and nix misbehaving features with a kill switch. You can check out the 14-day free trial and experience how CloudBees Rollout can help you rock every release. Follow the link in your podcast player right now or visit rollout.io for your 14-day free trial. Our thanks to CloudBees Rollout for sponsoring this episode of the podcast.
You made a point about form controls needing to work. I thought, because some of this is like, not only do we need new elements, but we need ways to style the old elements that aren't so bad. You know, like, I was like, sometimes we learn how to do something and we're like, well, that's just the way it is. So that's it forever. For example, styling a checkbox. It's not that hard to do these days. So many people do it that it's kind of entered our front end developer brain a little bit. Like, oh, well, you just hide the checkbox and you replace it with an element that or a label that's attached to the, you know, or you can, it's a pseudo element on the label or something. So the click handler behaves the same way. And then you use the checked selector to target it when it's in that particular state and apply your own styling and blah, blah, blah. Like, fine, that's neat or whatever.
You visually hidden the actual checkbox.
Right. But still position it over top of the original. That's a Sarah Swaydan trick, which I love because some people like visually explore on a touch screen to find something like a checkbox. And if you put it off the page, they won't be able to find it because there's a little haptic feedback when you actually find a checkbox. So like just make it opacity zero and place it on top of the custom checkbox because then you can still find it with your finger, which is cool. Yeah. I learned that in a smashing conf. That was a cool trick.
That's why you go to conference, kids.
Anyway, you know what? Another way to do it is standardize some freaking styles so we can style them ourselves without weirdness, you know?
Which I think the Edge team is starting to work on, at least for Chrome. So,
Right. That's what's encouraging to me. So there's, you know, a bunch of, they looked at data and said, okay, people want tabs. Dave Rupert, he wants tabs. And
I've emailed them dozens of times.
Yep. Absolutely. I want tabs too. Tabs would be a great one and accordions and whatever else. But their data shows that the stylable thing that people want the most is form controls, and they want select specifically. Selects are the worst things to style. So, yeah. And then like, what does that mean exactly? Like style what? Control what? And they have all this great research, you know, kind of led by Nicole and Greg Whitworth that are like, well, you know, it turns out you can kind of style the outside of it, you know, and Scott Gell and Filament Group have this great demo of cross browser being able to really style what it looks like on the outside. But then you open it up and it's still just browser Chrome. You know, it's like you aesthetically, the outside is fine, but the inside is what more people actually want to style. And in fact, styling the outside was like the third most asked for thing. What people really wanted is to, like, I don't know, be able to style what that drop-down menu looks like and where to put it, and that you could put actual custom HTML in there, not just a string, or that you could style it with CSS, or you can programmatically update it as, you know, server requests are made. Right now, if you touch that HTML, it'll close itself, you know, so you can't touch it without it closing. People hate that. The biggest one, though, is search. People want, like, fuzzy search in there, be able to you know, type in something in the middle of a string and have it show and not just jump to a result, but show just like a filtered set of results, almost like data list works like. So people have all these requests for it. And what's cool about all those requests is you can kind of do all of them without breaking fundamentally what a select is. This is just some exposed styling and behavioral stuff, but it will still behave like a select. And I was thinking like, well, what about multi-select? Don't people want that too? I want to be able to open a select and pick two cities that I want to live in or something.
Yeah.
That does break selects. You can't do that because that's a fundamental thing that select doesn't do. So that's a moment where you're like, okay, STD multi-select then as a custom component does make sense because it's different. Mm-hmm. It's a different UX experience. So I like the distinguishing features there. Like Toast makes sense because it's just a div with some behavioral stuff. So I like standard elements when it does something new and above and beyond that doesn't exist right now. But if it's just a matter of styling, like how to like expose some controls for how a checkbox works, that would be nice. Like I almost don't think we need a switch element because a switch only has two values and it's just a checkbox. So expose something that allows me to style a checkbox like a toggle.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, it would be cool if we could. Yeah, I don't know. I think most people, I think people still do like they'll reach for whatever npm install bootstrap custom checkbox or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. So like I, Dave Rupert, want to like get out of that situation where like encourage people to be like, yeah, it's only like five things, just style it yourself, like just write your own CSS file for once, you know. But you know, I think we're just in such a, oh, here's a problem, I'll just npm and fix it, and that's good and like get your job done. I don't want to stop you from that, but some of the stuff isn't super hard, you know, and we, you know, you can like just I want it to be where it's not hard, you know. That's why I want tabs and dialogues so that like when people make them, it's not just, you know, inaccessible crud on the page, you know. I want people to like have like a primitive a browser primitive that they can style and customize to make look cool. So but we don't have that yet, so.
This episode is brought to you by Netlify. Now, I personally love Netlify because it makes it super easy to build and launch Jamstack-style sites using Gatsby or 11D and other fun tech. If you build bigger and fancier apps and websites, you might be interested to know that Netlify recently launched monorepo support. It was one of their long-standing feature requests among their customers. Before this, there was no easy way to use the same repository and deploy it across multiple Netlify sites. Now, what is a monorepo, you might ask, as I did? A monorepo is a repository that contains multiple sites or apps, each in its own subdirectory. Using a single repository for multiple projects can help you more easily track and manage the elements they have in common. So how does it work? When you specify a base directory for your site, Netlify's build engine will only publish and deploy a build if there are changes in that directory. In an event where no changes are detected, your build would be automatically canceled. This makes it really simple to manage and deploy multiple sites from one repository. They also introduced a new config option, build.ignore. It will allow you to skip builds triggered for sites that observe no change in content. This new config option makes splitting your monorepo into multiple Netlify sites much more efficient. If you want to learn more, be sure to check out Netlify's new and improved support docs. You can check them out at netlify.com. Our thanks to Netlify for sponsoring this episode.
Well, while we're on all this interesting browser standard stuff, like we tend to get derailed on for a while, I think this was the oldest question in our list of questions that users sent in. So this was probably sent in years ago. Sorry, Andrew Potler wrote in. He's wondering about specifically that there's this the W3C proposed standard called encrypted media and encrypted media extensions. He wrote in, I hadn't heard much about it outside of this episode of Reply All. Let's see when that Reply All was published. It was probably a long time ago. March 2nd, 2017. So not that long ago, but 2 years ago, you know. It's hard to distill what they discuss in the episode, but He's just saying that W3C is proposing a standard that would encrypt media in a black box sort of way that wouldn't allow anyone to look at the encryption or poke holes in it to see if there are problems, you know. And they spoke to like Netflix and YouTube and all this stuff because, of course, media meaning like audio and video and shipping it in an encrypted way instead of an unencrypted way. Obviously, Netflix is pretty into an idea like that. Like, they have to in some way.
Sorry, Andrew.
They can't just, like, make, like, you know, Orange's New Black Season 2 EP5.mp4 and just let you download it, you know? Like, that's probably not, like, a super good business model for them. So they need to solve this on the web anyway somehow. And so I think back, you know, a couple of years ago, there's a lot of discussion about, like, well, should we keep... you know, keep forcing people to download a Flash player because they do solve this problem, or a Silverlight player because they solve this problem, or should the, you know, web standards bodies that be get into this? So do you remember all this?
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely like a, you know, a contentious point, you know, and I think the biggest contention was maybe when Firefox was like, yeah, we're going to build encrypted media extension, you know, and Boing Boing and anti-DRM people were very, very upset. Cory Doctorow types, and rightly so. I mean, like you say, the web's an open platform, but then you're like, but if you're a box office movie, you get the secret platform. You get like whatever. Paid only codes.
Right. It's a little weird. You can see it on both sides, right? You're like, obviously Netflix needs to work on the web. It's like a big deal for the web and they need something like this. So if you're Firefox, the business, Mozilla, the business, and you're just going to say, no, we're not going to solve that problem for you. Then you're like, how good of a business are you? You know?
Right. Yeah. No, I mean,
Well, what happened? This was 2 years ago. I mean, I'll tell you what
happened.
It's
in every browser.
It freaking happened. Yeah. And Netflix uses it and YouTube uses it.
And you can see it occasionally. You know, you'll like web inspect Netflix or whatever. And there's like, you know, no video tag or, you know, or the video tag and it's like blob, blah, blah, blah. But like, it's not, you like try to go to that blob or whatever. And it, you know, it's not going to be like a 7 gigabyte blob on your page. But like, it's just a reference to a URL that you can't access like directly. So only that page with that credential or whatever can access it. So
The fallout was fascinating. It was, you know, the EFF like pieces out of the W3C. They're like, this is so bad for the web. I'm gone. And then, but then Tim Berners-Lee saying like, you'd think I'd be against this, but I'm actually for it, which was a weird twist. So it was a fascinating little story. And, you know, in 2 years later, it's kind of like, did the web die? No. Was it good for the web? I don't know. You can't A-B test history. So,
well, and I think where it gets sort of shady is like, you know, encrypting certain images or something, or like this image only works on Tumblr or something like that. Or, you know, and that's maybe not a technology that exists right now, but it could, you know, GIFs. Like what if Giphy's like, F y'all. All these GIFs we have, they're all encrypted now. They're only work from Giphy and Giphy.com, like, or, you know, situations we like whitelist or whatever. Like, that sucks. So, you know, Imgur could do the same thing. But then, like, or PDFs would be another one, you know, like, what if you had to, like, EME on PDFs? And then you're like, okay, now all this knowledge is locked up. But, you know, then I can also, you know, you can Google like any book in the world and get a free download copy somewhere on the internet. You know, I could probably look for Practical SVG here and get a couple bootlegs.
In fact, just
you know
a couple of weeks ago, we cease and desisted somebody that was doing that, which normally I don't care and don't do that. But a book apart, well, does it? They have a system for it and it worked immediately. So anyway, I don't know. It was just a little side story.
Well, and they have to. That's like the copyright law in America, at least, is like, if you don't protect it, you lose it, right? So, like, that sucks, but that's how it goes. So, all to say, I mean, it's probably a net win that we can watch Netflix and YouTube on however we want, but it's maybe, I don't know. I wonder if it's a net loss for, like, remix culture and stuff like that, you know,
Yeah.
I think about this a lot. Like when I buy a movie on iTunes or Microsoft or whatever store, I don't actually own it. I just own a all you can watch pass, season pass. I paid $20 for an all you can watch season pass for one file on the internet. I paid $20 for that. Like, that seems stupid. Like, I don't own it like a DVD. It's not like a physical thing I own. It's just an all you can watch pass on a website, on a one website, basically.
Yeah, you want to watch it on another website, you got to pay for it.
Oh, you got to pay another $20 for that. So.
There is some evidence that not doing it this way also works. I remember I was astounded that this happened, but I remember when iTunes, I mean, this is a lot of years ago now, just removed all DRM from all downloads of music from the store of iTunes. Now, mm-hmm. if you buy a song for 99 cents from iTunes, you just get it. If I want to send it to Dave, I send it to you, and it just works, which is just bizarre. Because of course, they for a long time they also were all locked up, and not you couldn't do that. So now their bet was, you know, like why bother with all this crap when people are going to buy it anyway? Because what you're buying is like the UX of how convenient that is. Like, oh, I want that song. Click now, I have it. You know that they're going to sell just as many that way, or perhaps more because it's not, you know, all garbaged up and complicated. And because I think the DRM stuff isn't just like a one-off. Like, I think it causes extended confusion and slipperiness and problems, and you buy a new phone and it gets weird, and you lose the device and it gets weird, and it's not just a one-off problem. It's like this persistent problem, and if you just rip it all away, the UX is so much better that perhaps you even sell more. And they haven't turned their back on it as far as I know, so there's some evidence there. It's like Netflix is so convenient. You're not paying for, you know, if I could just torrent, I could torrent Orange Is New Black, but I don't because it's so much more convenient to just open Netflix and freaking watch the show. So you'd think if they removed all DRM, it probably wouldn't hurt them significantly. I wouldn't think.
Yeah, you pay $9 and you don't have to go through the torrenting experience, you know, and then. Yeah, and to be honest, like I don't want those things on my hard drive. I don't want, you know, kind of disposable shows or whatever.
Yeah,
know, but,
yeah.
But sometimes you get forced to like buy something. Like I bought the Mr. Rogers documentary and I own it. Nope. I own just a season pass to a file for $14.99, you know, and that's okay. I'll probably watch it a few times in my lifetime, but not really. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So. It's tricky that how tied to platform it is. And I should say, I'm not an expert in any of this stuff. I'm just like speaking as like a consumer and lightly informed technologist on all this. So there probably is big things that we're missing here. Very sorry. Please feel free to yell at us over email. I've been an Apple ecosystem nerd forever. So my Apple TV, which is exclusively what we listen to or use on our TV at home, is just full of stuff. You know, I mean, of course we use
Chock-a-block.
We use Netflix and Hulu and HBO now, and we got the whole suite of things because I think all of them together are cheaper than a basic cable plan anyway. And now we have like premium, great, whatever we want to watch that's like in the cultural zeitgeist, whatever. Like I have no problem paying for all that stuff. In fact, I think we even have some live TV because Hulu offers it. We have the Hulu plan that does it. So I can watch a little college football on Sunday or Saturdays if I want to, which I do once in a while. And altogether, it's cheaper than a damn college plan. Anyway, Castle Rock is out on Hulu, which I'm excited about. That was a good. Oh. You watched that? It was like a Stephen King universe show. That was good. I liked the first season of a lot. I was excited they actually made a second season on Hulu. Now I just thought about Hulu for a minute. But the point of all this is what happens when, like, most of our stuff, though, most of the money in investment has been in purchasing through the iTunes store shows and movies over a decade or longer or whatever, as long the day it launched, I'm sure I bought a movie. You know, I'm just that kind of nerd. And it's great now. I can go into our movie section and we have quite the library of movies in there. But that's totally, I mean, there is a day that will just be gone. What do you think?
No, I mean, probably. Or like you pay Apple or whoever like $20 or $2 a movie to just get the cloud pass, you know, like you don't need that hard drive.
What is going to happen anymore? When I'm a 60-year-old man, am I going to still have access to the fact that I bought Short Circuit on the iTunes music store when I was 26 years old?
Oh,
am
you're
I
going to have it? That would be, I don't know. That's the thing. I don't know. Who knows? Like, I mean,
I just got to assume it's no.
That, I think that's sort of the problem, like with DRM in general, is just it's only a thing that works on a thing as long as that thing exists. And there may be like let's say Apple closes their video. They're like, oh, it's not profitable anymore. We're selling off our although they just launched a whole TV channel. So whatever, probably not anytime soon. But like, let's say they're like, oh, these movies are a competitor to us. So now we're going to shutter our movie division, Apple Movies or whatever. Like, what do you do? Do you just lose it? I don't know if you lose the file. I bet somebody comes through and is like, okay, we're Movie Warehouse, and you can sign up for a Movie Warehouse account, and we bought all the Apple, you know, you can transition. I know like Microsoft Groove, which you probably never used, but it was really good, transitioned people over to Spotify. So like, I guess, you know, there'll probably be like a handoff if in the future, that goes.
But. Yeah, possibly. Like, oh, Smug Mug owns Flickr, or the greatest tech acquisition of all time, how Pinboard owns Delicious. Literally,
finally,
the greatest thing that's ever happened in tech.
Vindication. Oh, boy. You want to do one more question here?
We have a few minutes. Why not knock something out? Do you want to pick something to talk about?
Yeah, let's see here. Daniel Weber, I've been reading a lot about bosses wanting to start coding, and now it's happened to me. He's always commented on how he thinks he could do it when I show him something, but I brush it off, you know, I spent a decade doing this stuff, and he thinks he can spend a week and start pitching in. I'm mortified. Am I overreacting? Should I entertain him and hope it's just a phase he's going through? He's a nice enough guy, and so and a great boss, so I don't want to not slagging that off, but just want how to accommodate the code that is entering into the project. So pointed him to Udemy courses, and now he's messing around with Angular CLI and feels like he's getting pretty good. So what do I do? And maybe we should bleep out his name just in case his boss listens to this. But what do you do? What, the boss learns the code, Chris? What?
I think it's like kind of a hilarious sounding situation where, you know, you show him something in a meeting or something, and he's like, I could do that. What?
No.
What? Yeah. That's a weird reaction originally. You're like, what, are we not going to talk about the thing that I'm showing? You're going to talk about how presumably easy it was for me to do and how you could do it? Like, that is straight up prickery. Like, screw you.
Yeah, there's some hubris afoot. Right?
Yeah.
Like, what are you guys doing? Coding? I could do that. Me showing up to a basketball court. What's this, basketball? I got it. Like, pass me the ball. Pass me the ball.
And then your first shot like actually goes in, and then you're like, see?
See? Told you. Easy. How much y'all practice? I don't need to practice.
So it's like learning Angular, it sounds like. That. Okay. You know, I mean, fine, though. Like, if it's your boss being like, I'm actually interested in a little bit of a role transition here, and I think I could be useful to the team in more ways than just doing this ship, or I'm actually learning to code because I want to be able to talk and communicate with you in a better way. There's all these healthy ways you could approach it, but it's the way you've painted this.
Oops.
Sorry. We shouldn't be using your name, but
we'll bleep your last name for sure.
that it doesn't sound like that. It sounds like, you know, if not nefarious, then like accidentally nefarious in a bad way kind of thing. And it's whatever, you know, like if your boss wants to get into coding, then there needs to be it needs to be talked about in some kind of normal, healthy way. Instead of, you know, and the worst thing that can happen is that he starts undervaluing what you do or slows down the whole project because now you're just you're trying to accommodate his code, as you put it, which, you know, shoots. Can't you paint that picture back? Be like, you know how we used to move fast on stuff and now we move slow because you're, you know, I don't know, to pass the ball to Dave on the basketball team once in a while.
I would say I would say something like that. Like, hey, I want you to learn. Like, I think it's always good to learn. That's me, Dave Rupert, talking. I think it's always good that somebody wants to learn and pick up a skill. For me too, like having a manager that at least sort of understands technical limitations is huge. I mean, to the point where I may not work with another manager who does not understand technical limitations. Do you know what I mean? Like if somebody's just like, hey, build that thing. You're like, dude, that thing costs, that's going to be the next 5-10 years. Yeah, I think it'd be a really cool feature. You know, like those, I can't do that. You know, like I can't just like spend time on bad ideas. And then when I try to explain bad ideas, somebody's like, I don't get it. So it seems easy, you know, and that's maybe the problem our friend is in. But I think it's good that people are learning. I think having a technically minded, proficient manager is really good. I do think you should have like that tough conversation of like, hey, this, like, I'm up for this. Like, I can teach you how to code. Like, we can sit down, we can have kind of mentoring or reviews and stuff like that. But this is going to impact my productivity. Like, I just want, cause like now I have to do more time in code reviews and things like that. So like, there's a trade-off and just ask like, do you want to do this on the production code or would you like to do this on a side project that you're not like non-critical things that we can do in our spare time or like you can pay me to do in the spare time. You don't owe this guy anything. But yeah, I would say and maybe that's it too, is don't put him on the production thing. Maybe like if he's starting to pitch in, he should do it on the,
there you go,
the side project, like the low impact thing that can go wrong. So I think that would be my,
it's like putting the shoulder, it's making oops be the manager all of a sudden, you know?
Yeah, it's flipping the script. I mean, now you're the senior dev, like the whatever technical lead or whatever.
Who has to manage their manager? Like, that's not cool.
It's a weird, it breaks the hierarchy a bit, like the structural organization structure a bit. And maybe there's another manager that you could talk to. But if it's just the like boss, like maybe it is a very shallow company. So maybe you don't have many options. So I don't know. I just would have that candid conversation. Like I can, like, I want you to learn, like we should do learning, but like we have to, like it's not free. So like, and so it's going to slow us down in code reviews and fixes and things like that. So
that's the point.
All right. Well, hopefully that helped. And hopefully you enjoyed this episode. Shopping Maniacs, thank you for listening. And your podcatcher choice, be sure to star heart favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, ever shoptalkshow.com/jobs to get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
ShopTalkShow.com.